I'm Dr. Brian Goldman, host of the CBC podcast, The Dose. Each week, we answer health topics in a smart and sometimes counterintuitive way you won't hear anywhere else. Like, what's the least amount of exercise I can do to get the benefits? Which psychedelics can improve my mental health? And how can I check for cancer if I don't have a family doctor? Top experts help me bring you what you need to know in plain language in about 20 minutes. Find The Dose on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hi, I'm Nora Young. This is Spark and our special series, The Butterfly Effect. A central idea of chaos theory is that changes to initial conditions of a system will affect its outcomes. There's a classic metaphor for illustrating this. Something as small as a butterfly flapping its wings on one side of the ocean can lead to a tornado on the other side. In other words, a seemingly minor action can set a system on a massively different course of events. And that's what we're focusing on in this series. Over the course of 10 episodes, we'll look at small inventions that have gone on to change the world. So much so that it's hard to imagine what life would be like without them. Welcome to The Butterfly Effect. Unlike many CBC shows, Spark isn't live, so I'm not actually here right now. You're listening to a recording of me. Depending on when you're listening, maybe I'm working on a different episode, or spelunking in a cave, or eating a sandwich. No big deal, right? But think about it. Wherever we are in the world, we're used to being able to listen to audio recorded anywhere else in the world and from any time.
In a place that we couldn't recognize.
Podcasts. All that music. Voicemail.
You have one.
Historical records.
At the stroke of the midnight hour.
Old news broadcasts.
Tonight in Kingston, Citizens Forum will discuss.
Recorded sound has enriched our lives for nearly 150 years. And that's what we're going to talk about today for the final episode of The Butterfly Effect, the incredible impact of the audio recorder. And it's all thanks to American inventor Thomas Edison, who in 1877 revealed his talking machine. Not exactly.
My name's Patrick Feaster. I'm an audio historian and co-founder of the First Sounds Initiative.
Patrick's involved in locating, making audible, and contextualizing many of the world's oldest sound recordings, including those that came two decades before Edison and in a place far, far different from Menlo Park, New Jersey. Paris, France in the 1850s.
There was an amateur inventor named Edouard Léon Scott de Martinville, whose day job was as a scientific proofreader. He would work with the manuscripts of scientific texts to get them into print. And one day he was working on a treatise on physiology that had a section in it describing how the human ear works. And he read about the eardrum and the other parts of the ear and what they did. And it inspired him. He thought, well, if any sound I can hear comes into my brain from making my eardrum move back and forth, well, shouldn't I be able to record any sound that I can hear by building an artificial eardrum, where instead of passing vibrations along to my nervous system and my brain, would write them down on a sheet of paper? And so his idea was to take a funnel that you could direct sounds into, stretch a membrane at one end of it that would vibrate the way an eardrum does, and then stick a little stylus onto the other side of the membrane, made out of something like a hog bristle or a piece of a shrimp, just something very lightweight that it could move back and forth very easily. And then he would cause that to rest against a piece of paper covered with soot wrapped around a drum. He'd move the drum around, rotating it with his hand, and as he shouted into this funnel, that stylus would move back and forth and leave a wavy line trace in the soot on the piece of paper. After that was done, he'd take the piece of paper off. He'd put it in a fixative bath, a little bit like what you'd use to fix a charcoal drawing so it wouldn't smudge. And then there's your recording. He has recorded sound. He called his invention a phonautograph, literally a sound self-writer, and these inscriptions it made he called phonautograms.
So those phonautograms were recordings, but on paper.
The idea of playback was never on the table for him. It just didn't occur to him. The whole purpose here was to make a visual record of sound so that you could study it, take it in visually.
More like receiving a fax than hearing back a voice memo.
Now, to us, we're familiar with the idea of playback. This might seem as though it hasn't really finished the job. You've recorded sound, but you haven't really done anything useful with it.
Well, yeah. And yet, we just heard Edouard Léon Scott de Martinville himself singing the French folk song Au clair de la lune in 1860. And that's because, in 2008, Patrick and his colleagues at First Sounds developed a way to play back the visual recordings Scott de Martinville made.
Basically, it all boils down to getting a piece of software to convert that wavy line into a set of samples in an audio file,
making it the earliest recovered recording of the human voice known to exist to date. But why did the idea of playback never occur to Scott de Martinville?
If you put yourself back into the mindset of someone who lived before the idea of playback was even a thing, writing sound down on a piece of paper was really pretty cool. You can just imagine what kinds of things this could open up for you. Up until then, any sound that ever existed in the history of the world was made once, left no trace of itself, disappeared forever. So he thought, well, from now on, maybe great actors of the stage, great singers of the opera, will stand in front of the phonautograph. They'll record their arias as these wavy lines on pieces of paper. And in the future, people will learn to read these. You might sit down in your chair with a book of phonautograms, and you'd open it up to a great aria by your famous vocalist, and you'd read it, and maybe somehow you'd listen in your mind's ear to what it would have sounded like.
Which, of course, is a vision of the future that did not come true. Then in 1877, way over in America,
Thomas Edison was working on the telephone, and so he was doing all kinds of things with membranes and wires and just anything that you could think of that would be involved in tinkering with telephones. One thing he was working on was a machine to repeat telegraph messages. Of course, at this point, you could send telegraph messages a certain distance, but no further, and so you'd have to repeat to get them from one end to the other. So he thought, well, it'd be nice if you could record them and play them back.
Play them back! Now there's a vision of the future.
So he'd been working on this machine for doing that with Morse code. And one time he'd taken this machine and ran it at super high speed. And the dots and dashes to his ear sounded a little bit like indistinct human speech. And he takes a strip of paper with wax on it, paraffin, runs it underneath a mouthpiece with a little point on it, shouting, "Hello!" And then runs this little sheet back underneath it another time, and this faint "Ooh!" comes out. So he knows he's onto something. So that's where the whole idea came from.
What kinds of audio were being recorded in those early years? Like, what kinds of sounds do people want to capture?
Edison's first idea was very pedestrian. So this will be wonderful. You see, right now, a businessman wants to dictate a letter. You have to hire a stenographer to take down the person's words. Well, if he can record what he wants to say using a phonograph, you can just play the record back at, you know, a quarter of the speed and have any old person write his words down. You don't have to pay stenographers anymore. And, you know, as he thought this through, a few other ideas came up. You could send spoken letters through the mail. Maybe you could put phonographic records into dolls and make them talk and sing. But, you know, the idea of the phonograph as entertainment was among maybe the first 10 or so ideas he came up with for it, but it was not at the top of the list. He came up with this device, we refer to it now as the tinfoil phonograph. It's a sheet of tinfoil wrapped around a drum with a groove in it. And you make a record by indenting the tinfoil, and you play it back just by running a stylus back over those indentations in the tinfoil. It made an absolute sensation on the entertainment circuit. People would go around with these machines and give exhibitions with them during 1878. You'd have people play a cornet into it and then play it back, or you'd recite a nursery rhyme into it and play it back. It was wonderful, really fun, exciting, proved that it worked, but utterly useless for any practical purpose. So it was really only useful for demonstrating this exciting new idea. But so in 1888, he finally comes up with a way of making more or less permanent records on wax cylinders, which you can take off the machine and then put back on again. So that's when some interesting scenarios finally become possible.
Yeah. So when did the phonograph become, if I can put it this way, part of the cultural scene, like beyond this sort of scientific and technical novelty to actually being more broadly distributed?
During the early 1890s, people began experiencing these new wax cylinder phonographs, not at home at first, but in public places. There would be nickel in the slot machines you could go up to, stick a coin into, and then listen through ear tubes to someone telling a funny story or a band playing a piece of music, something like that. It was really the mid-1890s to early 19-aughts when the phonograph finally took on a form that people could welcome into their homes. And, in the early 20th century, they start working out methods of duplicating records in large numbers. I'd say about then you could say the phonograph has really become a mass medium.
And so when then did electric recording practices come on the scene, like electric microphones and that sort of thing?
Up until the mid-1920s, all sound recordings were made acoustically. So it's the sheer mechanical force of sound waves making that membrane move back and forth. Electricity enters the picture in the mid-1920s. So from that time forward, the acoustic range, the sound quality of recordings increases dramatically. Up until that point, if you wanted to make a good record, you had to do all kinds of crazy things. If you were a vocalist, you'd have to learn all kinds of special techniques for modulating your voice, moving forwards or backwards when you hit particular notes so it doesn't blast, all sorts of things like that. But now, once microphones enter the scene, you can whisper and make a record, or you can pick up sounds on the other side of the room, or the characteristics of a hall will be important, the echo and so forth. It's just sound recording becomes a lot more sophisticated from that point forward. Sounds a lot more like you'd expect a sound recording to today.
Mm-hmm. And how did that development change the entertainment industry overall?
Well, it made it a lot easier to make a recording and made recordings a lot more sensitive. So it changed the range of factors that you could want to adjust in a studio setting. But in terms of popular music, the introduction of microphones, both in sound recordings and the radio, did affect the styles of music. Crooning becomes a thing at this point. Up until then, if you were a musical performer, you wanted to perform for an audience on, say, a vaudeville stage without microphones, well, you had to belt your song out in some way that people in the last row could maybe have a chance at hearing you. But now ways of speaking, ways of singing can change. Political speech can become more conversational, can sound more like you and me talking here right now.
The matter of union can only be rightly approached from the broad standpoint.
It does have a big effect that we may not think of on how we expect singing or talking or speech making to sound. And when we listen back to some of these very earliest sound recordings, it's really a bygone world of sound we get to listen to. Now, phonograph cylinders you could record yourself at home way back in the 1890s and 1900s. So home recording was kind of a thing back then. But, and you might not think it was, but you know, there are home recordings from back then, and they're really quite interesting to listen to. But then when the disc gramophone came along, for a while there, you couldn't make your own recordings that were compatible with that. So home recording went away for a number of years. Didn't happen very much.
You're listening to Spark from your friends at CBC Radio.
I'm Nora Young, and today, the final in our special series, The Butterfly Effect, all about the audio recorder. So far, audio historian Patrick Feaster has told us about early iterations of recording and playing back sound. As processes evolved, the way that sound was packaged was changing too, especially with the introduction of magnetic tape recording and vinyl records.
The LP was another big development. 78 RPM records, which were the standard disc format up until around World War II, 1950s, could play for 3, 4, 5 minutes, depending on their size. If you wanted to listen to a symphony, you'd have to get up and change the record quite a few times over the course of it. And, you know, the musicians would have to stop every so often so you could switch. You know, you'd have to rearrange classical music to be recordable in these 3, 4, 5 minute chunks. Or if you had an album of popular songs, well, it would literally be an album, like a photograph album. Now, the LP did away with a lot of that. It could play for a good deal longer, you know, maybe half an hour uninterrupted on a side. Then you'd have to get up and flip it. But, you know, based on what people were used to up until that point, that was pretty good. 33 and a third or 45 RPM. Those were at first two competing formats. Columbia came up with the LP. RCA Victor came up with the 45. And they really expected their format to take it all over. But people decided they liked different sizes and speeds of records for different purposes. And so kind of backfired. All the companies had to make both going forward.
And so then when do we start to see the tape format come into being?
The magnetic tape format becomes widespread shortly after World War II, and open reel audio tape, where you have just a reel of tape and you wind it onto another reel of tape, is fairly widespread. A lot of people had machines for playing that, but it was always a little trickier to use, always a little more specialized than LPs. So there was never really a time when people were, you know, seriously selling pre-recorded stuff on open reel tape. That was always a bit of a niche market. What really caused audio tape to become a cultural force was the audio cassette, where you had both of those reels conveniently combined into this little cartridge that was easy to stick into a machine and take out again. And So that was a lot more convenient, didn't require you to thread tape onto a reel and other things of that sort. So, you know, the audio cassette became a fairly serious contender in the audio field in the 70s, 80s, 90s. But audio cassette technology almost always came with read-write capability. If you had a tape player, it was almost certainly also a tape recorder. And so you have people, again, being able to make home recordings and making copies of commercial recordings, which, of course, caused a great deal of concern. And mixtapes. So you don't like the order of tracks on that album, mix them up your own way, or, make a special mix for your friends and loved ones. Lots of possibilities there.
I could say the word mixtape to anyone, and it starts a conversation. Hi, my name is Summer McCoy, and I'm the chief curator of the Mixtape Museum.
That's right. There's a mixtape museum based in New York City, and that's a testament to the rich cultural history of the humble cassette.
The main priority is to celebrate the cassette and supporting what I call mixtape scholars and mixtape studies, where we're looking at mixtapes as artifacts, right? They are records of time place and situation, they are just as important as, you know, vinyl or a book or any other archival asset or material. And they should be prioritized and written about and studied. And, you know, resources should be put behind saving them. And not just hip hop, right? That was my entry into the project. And as I've developed it, I've been talking to people that use the cassette and the mixtape in many, many different ways, right? Not even just music. I have a friend whose dissertation was in the form of a mixtape. She's a doctor, and that's how she decided to present her research out into the world. So it's also diving into people's imagination and their emotion and memory and seeing how they define what a mixtape is and helps us talk about like what makes us all different and also like where we can all connect.
Audio recording has had an incredible reach over the last 100 plus years, and it's taken many different forms and formats. We want to focus on the mixtape, though, because it's a great example of the creative power unleashed through the democratization of recording and distributing audio, in particular, in the rise of hip-hop. So can you paint a little scene for us? What was it like trying to record a mixtape using cassettes and a boombox? What did you have to do?
Wow, it was a labor of love. Timing is really important, making sure you're in front of the radio. And then it was also timing to not catch the commercials, mm-hmm. right? But what would happen is you would get either the tail end of it or like the beginning of it if you didn't cut it off. And what I'm finding now as I'm going back and trying to archive these tapes, those commercials are really important because they help give you context to the recording, the time, radio station, and all those things.
Right, of course.
WBLS. Yeah, and then on top of recording, it was figuring out the order of songs, right? Who are you making it for? Are you filling out the J card, which is the insert, which was really important because that is our liner notes, which we kind of lose nowadays, or special notes that may be from, you know, Summer to Nora. If I'm making a tape for you, it may give the date where I was. Mm-hmm. And then if you copied that same tape to give it to someone else, your J card may look different. The front of your tape may look different.
Yeah. I also, it seems to me, I remember that there would often be, you know, you'd do a whole side of the cassette and then you'd have like 45 seconds left at the end or whatever that you had to try and fill in with some like little bit of, you know, comedy or something to make it to the end of the tape.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's funny. I was just talking about this with a friend. The 120-minute tapes were the tapes that they were more expensive, right? But they were the tapes you wanted because you got more on them. But I've heard from some people that, like, sometimes the 60-minute tapes are more stable for whatever reason. Huh. But, yeah, I always went after the 120-minute tapes. And I just remember I grew up on the east side of New York City, borderline of the East Village, and I remember walking to the Wiz, walking to Tower Records to go and buy blank tapes, but you knew that only certain stores had the certain brands with the certain time.
Yeah.
This is Spark from CBC Radio.
Yeah, we're gonna do a little something like this.
Hello, I'm Jess Milton. For 15 years, I produced The Vinyl Cafe with the late, great Stuart McLean. Every week, more than 2 million people tuned in to hear funny, fictional, feel-good stories about Dave and his family. We're excited to welcome you back to the warm and welcoming world of The Vinyl Cafe with our new podcast, Backstage at The Vinyl Cafe. Each week, we'll share 2 hilarious stories by Stuart, and for the first time ever, I'll tell you what it was like behind the scenes. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Nora Young. This is The Butterfly Effect, Spark's special series on the surprising scope and range of seemingly small technological innovations, this time the impact of the audio recorder. Earlier we heard from audio historian Patrick Feaster about the invention and evolution of recorded sound, from the phonautograph, which recorded sound but couldn't play it back, to the incredible versatility of magnetic tape. And although Patrick spends most of his time looking at the history of sound media, I wanted to know his thoughts on the future and what's next for audio.
Well, like everybody else, I'm really intrigued by what artificial intelligence is bringing us. You know, it's always a mix of fascination, what's suddenly possible, and horror at how it might be misused. I'd say that one of the things that that people were impressed by back in the 1870s when sound recording was wonderfully new and people were trying to figure out how it was going to change the world. One of their observations was that it would be unfalsifiable because you could forge somebody's handwriting, but nobody could ever forge somebody's voice. But now today with deepfakes, it turns out that, in fact, you can do exactly that. We're all trying to figure out how do we come to terms with this now, the fact that a politician's voice might be faked, and how can you tell what's real anymore? And I suspect going forward that while the cat's out of the bag, that's part of the way audio will work going forward. So we may end up looking back at the last 150 years as this blip in time in the long run, back when we'd figured out how to record sound, but not how to fake it.
Patrick Feaster is an audio historian and co-founder of the First Sounds Initiative. He's based in Bloomington, Indiana. If you're curious about those very early audio snippets, head on over to our website, cbc.ca/spark. Now, there are many directions we could have gone when putting this episode together. Advances in recording technology have been fast and sometimes cutthroat over the past 150 years. Earlier, you heard a bit of Summer McCoy talking about the mixtape. We decided to take some time to focus on the enduring cultural impact of cassette mixtapes in particular. The role that mixtapes played in the grassroots hip-hop movement historically and in Black American culture more broadly is significant. It's a fascinating example of the role that audio plays in shaping culture, and what can happen when the tools for spreading culture are broadly distributed. Here's more with Summer McCoy, chief curator of the Mixtape Museum in New York.
I have had a lot of conversations with Paradise Gray, who grew up in the Bronx and is the chief curator of the Universal Hip Hop Museum and founder of the Paradise Gray Collection. And we were actually researching mixtapes in his collection because they date all the way to late 70s. And he talks about the community being able to gatekeep the music that was made in the community to keep it for the community, right? And what he meant by that is, let's say there was a party, right? And a DJ recorded their set, made copies of it. That tape, they didn't easily like leave the community.
Right.
But if it did, it meant whoever was getting it, maybe it wasn't about the money. Maybe it was, we just don't want you to have it. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. You know, the dichotomy of that is it's also how the music made it out of the community, right? To spread hip hop. And what was special about the cassette was with the boombox, for a lot of artists, it was their final release, right? They didn't have record deals.
Right.
So I record my album and that may be how I market myself, right? Is through that tape that I made at home and then we're making copies of it.
So does that mean that the mixtape had a particular value for emerging DJs and emerging artists?
I mean, for hip hop in general, I mean, hip hop was emerging in the beginning.
Right. It was all emerging.
No, but it's a good question because even there were different artists and DJs that may have had different access, right? Maybe there were DJs that were at clubs, right? Being booked at a club downtown, right? Or in Harlem. And they could record their set and they could share it and get it out there. Whereas another DJ, maybe I'm just being booked in the park. At a park jam, right? And there's not that downtown crowd. It's just, you know, my local neighborhood. If I could record my set, maybe I could actually get outside of my neighborhood and get booked for a club, right? So it actually became part of their marketing and promotion. And back then, the DJ was the center, right? And the MC was like on the sidelines, whereas now we've kind of reversed that role. Mm-hmm. But I think it also helped DJs to keep that position as being the center or the central voice, you know, of hip hop. And I think with the cassette, with mixtapes, especially into the 2000s with the Justo Mixtape Awards.
I mean, the mixtape guys, they wasn't getting credit. So started the Mixtape Awards in 1995. And since then,
where DJs were getting awards for using their mixtapes to promote themselves, to promote their artistry, to promote other artists, you know? It was something special. It was a tool that they were able to use.
Can you expand a little bit on how the mixtape chain of distribution worked? Like, what would the steps involve?
Yeah, earlier when DJs were recording their sets at clubs, right? I'm a DJ, I record my set, make copies of it, or maybe pay someone to make copies of it. And, you know, I can just sell it wherever I am, right? Back then, there were this OJ cab service in Harlem, which was, I mean, think of Uber, but let's say Uber was promoting mixtapes, right? Where if you're in an Uber and you could hear Kid Capri or Jazzy Joyce tapes being played loudly, right? Through a window, whether you're in the car or you're not, you were able to hear, right. You were able to hear it. Later, when the more studio tapes were made, and what I mean by studio, it's not I'm just recording live at a club. I'm going to go home, or I'm going to go to my home studio or to a studio and create, intentionally create a mixtape for distribution, right? It becomes a little bit more rehearsed, if you will. Maybe it, you know, I'm able to add drops on it. Like, I want to give a shout out to Nora, right? Or any of those things. You can add the production. A lot of DJs have like Kid Capri. When you hear Kid Capri's tag, you know it's Kid Capri. Or you hear Jazzy Joyce, or you hear, you know, Red Alert. And then once the labels and artists like Diddy, 50 Cent, artists like that, or label owners like that started using tapes to promote their entire label, uh-huh. Right? So it would be like, we're going to put out, you know, G-Unit, I don't know, Volume 5 to promote the releases for our artists this summer. Then you're talking about a completely different distribution, right? Mm-hmm. So I may have a label helping me to distribute. And this is not, when I say mixtapes, then I'm saying these are CDs.
Okay.
But we're still calling them mixtapes because the name is just co-opted into a different era or time.
Sure.
But you still needed to have a hands-on, hand-to-hand distribution to get your tapes like out on Canal Street, right? Or on 14th Street. That was a less formal distribution. Mm-hmm. Historically, they were African and Chinese vendors. Where I grew up on 14th Street, like I could literally remember like where the stores were. And the stores were not like big stores. They were like the size of my, you know, like pantry.
Yeah, yeah.
right. But how they received those tapes were either a DJ said, here's a master, right? Or here's copies of my tape. Go sell them. Sometimes there's a distribution person in between the DJ and the vendor. And then, like I said, sometimes there's the label, right? Or sometimes you're getting it, a DJ's receiving mixtapes at a club for promotional use to be copied and distributed even more.
Right.
Distribution got really, really creative with mixtapes because it was by any means necessary, right?
Were there legal challenges for the mixtape market?
Yeah.
One or two?
Technically. Yeah, I mean, you're not supposed to sell them because the music that ends up on mixtapes a lot of the time are unofficial remixes, right? So I might take an R&B song from Mary J. Blige and a hip hop song by Jay-Z and get really creative and put it together, but it's not an official release, right? Mm-hmm. And then if I'm selling it, I mean, it's not legal. I think even before that, with there was a whole campaign, you know, with like home recording is killing the music industry or whatever. I feel like that was the industry could have got ahead of that and could have reaped the benefits of what they considered piracy, right? Because later on, what you saw, in examples, when I worked with the Clips, we had a budget every year for not even every year per project for mixtapes. To make sure that our music got to a DJ so that it ended up on a mixtape. Some of those DJs may have been selling those tapes, right? Or they were for promotional use only, which is the tag you would see on a tape. It didn't always mean that they weren't being sold. Do you know what I mean? And not necessarily from the DJ, but maybe it's a vendor on 125th Street that got a hot tape and was like, well, I'm just going to sell it and make money. And I think also they're hard to track, right? Now we track songs with metadata and all these things. I'm a database manager. So it's interesting looking at databases and then going back and looking at a cassette where you're missing a lot of that information. And then there's no digital tag, right? So it's hard to track those things.
Yeah.
But it's a huge it's still a question that's up in the air. And I think the biggest legal question now is, how do we compensate for the creativity that mixtapes gave us? How do we compensate for the remix, right? Where it's not just the artist and or the DJ, but it's like, what is this final piece of artistry that Ron G put together, you know, with hip hop and Mary J. Blige that blew up her career?
Right.
It's because of that creativity he had to say, well, the song's not doing well. Let me mix in some hip hop and add on my own special flair. And then the song's getting played on the radio. How do we compensate someone like Ron G, you know, who's responsible for many artist careers and then later on became a producer?
Mm-hmm.
And that's essentially what they're doing.
But then did you have a sense that maybe the labels would sort of turn a blind eye to some of this because it was in the end good for, say, Mary J. Blige's career?
Sure. It's two things can be true at the same time, right? But it's like, let's talk about it. And what does that look like now after so many DJs have put in the work and may feel like they've been slighted by, you know, the same industry that wants to pay them to do things, right? Or ask them to do things for free.
Mm-hmm. You're the chief curator of the Mixtape Museum, and in that role, you spend a lot of time archiving mixtapes. So how do you extract data from a cassette?
I want to save everything. So it's not just the sound. It's me looking up what kind of tape it was. What year was the tape made? How long was the tape? And then you start looking at scanning the J card, scanning the tape, and then the music or the sound that's on it, it's having that transferred over. And then after that, it's the long process of trying to figure out what is on it if you don't have information. I have a bunch of tapes that have nothing, like there is nothing.
Yeah.
Or it's, I can't read the handwriting. And even if you go listen to it, and I may be able to find, oh, I know that song, or oh, that's a remix. There's so many unofficial sounds on mixtapes or cassettes because we've made them in the privacy of our own homes or own studios, and maybe we didn't expect for them to ever make it out into the world. So we didn't label them, right? They were just for us. But imagine, let's say Beyonce made a tape, right? And it surfaces like 30 years later. Like, we want to know like what that experience was from Beyonce.
Right.
So outside of the sound, I also want the memory, right? When people listen to tapes and they can hear the digitized version loudly, it's just like, oh my gosh, it takes you back to what you were feeling, what you were doing at that moment. And then the stories start to flow. And that's what the mixtape memory collection has been for the Mixtape Museum, is either capturing the story with people that have thrown their cassettes out, because that has happened to many people, and reactivating that memory, even if they don't have the cassette. But if you do have the cassette, you know, it's the digitization, but then there's the stories after. And then working with someone like Paradise Gray, one tape means talking to all the people that he mentioned on the tape, all the people who might have been involved in the tape. There's just so much that can be done with being able to save one one single tape.
Highway 25.
I understand you spoke to the academic and political activist Angela Davis about the role that mixtapes played in social justice work. So,
oh my gosh.
First of all, amazing. But B, what did you learn?
Wow. So this conversation was very short. It was in a car taking her to the airport. And the cassette wasn't made originally for music, right? It was made for like office use. So if we think of the many communities that it takes me back to Dr. Jared Ball's book, Mixtapes as Emancipatory Journalism, which talked about like people not having access to radio, right? Or more traditional distribution channels, and finding distribution with the cassette and being able to get messages out.
Mm.
I have a friend named Olga who gave me tapes from when she was younger growing up in the USSR. And she talked about how those tapes were, you know, for things that she wasn't supposed to listen to.
Right.
And how it helped to cover up movements, right? So that they were not disrupted. So it's that same thing that Dr. Davis touched on, was they gave us a vehicle to get messages out. The fact that they were small, you could copy them, you could mail them.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually like now that the Mixtape Museum project is where it is, like, I am actually going to go back and try to get a formal mixtape memory from her, and actually expand on the idea of mixtapes and social justice, because we're still using them for social justice, just in different ways.
Summer McCoy is the chief curator of the Mixtape Museum in New York City. I'm Nora Young, and this is The Butterfly Effect here on Spark. That's where we look at the extensive and surprising impacts of a seemingly simple technology. Today, we're talking about the audio recorder in all its varied formats. As we've just heard, the development of music is tightly woven into the history of the audio recorder. But one of the amazing things about audio recording is the way it can bring sound from anywhere in the world to you. In radio, we talk about audio's ability to really take you somewhere, unleashed from the bounds of geography. And that can be illuminating, awe-inspiring, sounds of humans, nature, anything.
My name's Lawrence English. Someone once described me as a philosopher of listening, and that was much better than what I could come up with myself, so I just borrowed it.
Lawrence specializes in field recordings, recordings made out in the world away from a studio. We wanted to talk to Lawrence because his work has given him unique insight into what it really means to listen, to be a listener in our modern age. Because experientially and philosophically, listening to something recorded in another time and place is fundamentally different from the ancient human practice of, say, listening together to a story around a campfire. But first, a bit of history. The idea of field recordings goes back to the early days of the phonograph and an 8-year-old German boy named Ludwig Koch. He loved music and the sound of his family's pet birds. One day, using his wax cylinder recorder, he captured the sound of his favorite bird, a common shama. It was the first known recording of a bird, and Ludwig Koch would go on to become a renowned sound recordist and natural history broadcaster. His early recording of the bird would become part of a larger tradition.
When we talk about 1889 and we think about the phonograph, it was a commercial device which radically changed the way that people think about sound. And for me, the thing that's fascinating about it is that it was suddenly realized this promise of a sound being able to be recorded in one place and in one time, and then presented to an audience in another place and another time. And through doing that, completely recontextualizing the way that we think about sound as this kind of temporal event. I mean, Ludwig Koch had made these recordings basically as a child, obviously quite a privileged child to have access to a phonograph, but, you know, had this fascination that he was able to use a technology to exploit. And I think really field recording is about a kind of fascination. We've seen this explosion in the opportunities for people to become fascinated, you know, that there is an accessibility to technology that has basically progressed quite rapidly across the 20th century now into the 21st century, where people's curiosities have actually been able to be realized in a way that, you know, was impossible 170 years ago. And I think that Ludwig Koch example from 1889, it's a child's fascination with the sound of a bird that led to them recording that completely opened up a doorway, a pathway into a whole practice, which is now, you know, what myself and many other people find as their kind of primary way of engaging.
Mm. So in the early years of field recording, what kinds of things were people capturing?
Well, it was in a very different kind of way that we might think about field recording today. I think it's radically different to how the term was used. Like historically, the term was much more rooted in a kind of ethnographic tradition, which persisted really until the 1970s. You know, there was a shift, I think, in the late 60s, and there's a piece of sound by French composer Luc Ferrari, which for me really is the turning point, I think, in how we think about field recording, in that he removed himself out of this idea that had been prevalent during the 20th century about going to a place, recording a ritual, a sound, a space, and then presenting that as some kind of reference towards reality, or like a document. In the early days, field recordings were recognized as, they were kind of described as sound photographs, because at that point, the photograph was seen as this very realistic rendering, a capture of reality, you know. And I think that word capture is really interesting to look at, because it does kind of suggest a very particular way of viewing the world, that somehow it's absolute and it can be held even in something as kind of ephemeral as a sound recording.
Yeah. Can we talk a little bit more about that? And I know you've said that the rise of field recording was connected to ethnographic work that you know, has subsequently been found to be kind of problematic. So what's the realization there?
I think it's a really important question to think about how the ethnographic reading of field recordings kind of came apart. I think with field recording in that early 20th century period and up until the kind of late 60s, there was an anticipation that somehow truth could be told. There was an objective position that was held by the recordist. Fundamentally, we know now, of course, that's just not possible. As soon as the researcher enters it, in fact, there was one particular study by a French researcher around the Yanomami in the Amazon. And that really changed the way that a lot of people started to think about ethnography in the 20th century because of the introduction of certain items, situations that were undertaken by the research team in those communities, which radically changed the outcome of the research. And I think at the same time, there was a recognition that it wasn't this objective practice, that it was very much rooted in the interests of the people that were undertaking the research, the recording, whatever the case might be. I think as well, there is obviously a very important question around what kinds of things can be recorded and by who. And I think that that period, and certainly now, we're starting to see some really important dialogues around that, recognizing that not all sounds are available to all people, and potentially they shouldn't be, because there are community cultural practices that are just for those communities, just for those cultures. And the idea of like audio tourism, which I think has become a real thing, is something we need to grapple with in the same way that sort of, you know, the cultural tourism of the sort of mid-20th century. It's the same thing. You want to make sure that there isn't a kind of essentializing exoticism that creeps into the work. And I think, sadly, that is the case for a lot of recordings.
Lawrence has given a lot of thought to the more philosophical dimensions of field recording and recorded audio more broadly. The way we listen also affects our experience of sound and how we capture and share it.
As part of a study that I did a PhD a few years ago around this idea of listening, and specifically looking for a kind of, I guess, a theoretical approach to listening in a creative capacity. My interest was basically, we have this idea of field recordings. Somehow field recordings has arrived in this canon of sound arts, but there's not a lot of dialogue as to why or how it arrived there. Mm. So I thought that was an interesting problem to kind of address. And there's this really wonderful text by a French author called Peter Shendy. And he had these two provocations that for me completely summarized my relationship to field recording. Can one make a listening listen to? And if you can you transmit that listening as unique as it is? And for me, those two things recognize that the first statement recognizes that a listening is not listening. It's a kind of singular journey through many possible journeys in any moment. Like you might be at a restaurant and someone might be talking to you and the conversation next door is more interesting. So you're focused on that. You're not listening to that person that's sitting with you in that moment. Yeah. I think we've all been there. Mm-hmm. As awkward as it is, as soon as they say, what do you think? And you think, well, I think this other conversation is much more interesting. Thank you. it's a terrible confession. But that's a kind of great example of this idea of it's a listening. It's not a kind of universal state. Mm. It's a series of choices made moment to moment in time.
Yeah.
And then this second part of his provocation around the idea of can you transmit that listening as unique as it is kind of recognizes that we need a translation device if we're going to transmit that. And for me, the kind of prosthetic ear of the microphone became that device. Mm. And to think about that relationship then is to recognize that they're not going to be the same thing, because the microphone does not share your interests and preoccupations.
Yeah.
And that can be both wonderfully revealing, but also incredibly frustrating. And you have to kind of negotiate those two circumstances as a field recordist.
Yeah.
I do honestly think that human beings are much better at filtering out the world than they are at actually listening to it.
Mm-hmm. Can we talk a little bit about contemporary and emerging technologies and all this? I know that, you know, humans only hear sounds that register within a certain range of frequencies, but audio recording technology has advanced to a point where we can capture sounds that our ears can't. So what are some of the environments that we can now access sonically thanks to new technology?
Well, I mean, I think across the 20th century, there has been this pretty radical development in auditory technologies. I mean, if we think about LIGO, the Light Inframeter Gravitational Observatory, the kind of main research hub, is in California. What that facility was able to do in terms of its, if you like, listening into the galaxy, was to recognize and show that Einstein's theoretical position of the gravitational waves existing in our reality, it was able to demonstrate that there are indeed gravitational waves through the kind of auditory technologies that use by picking up the vibrations and showing that there was a flex, basically, in space-time. I mean, it's a kind of amazing confirmation of the theory, for one, but it also demonstrates how we can approach these sounds that are, or these vibrations and these waves that are existing far in excess of where we are, what we have at our command as human beings.
I was going to ask you about this sort of galactic recording, because I think in one of your articles, you actually had the sound of, was it black holes colliding or?
So yeah, there was this fantastic moment where LIGO was able to capture the sound of these two black holes colliding together. And when you hear the actual sound, it's a series of data sources that are sonified. So it is not the sound, because in fact, some sounds exist outside of our capacity to capture them with our ears, and we need translation devices. Mm-hmm. So LIGO has built this incredible translation device where they can capture these sounds that exist at a galactic level, or these potentially sonic events that exist at a galactic level, and translate them into something that we can approach as human beings, because some things are too much for us to appreciate, which I think is completely beautiful. We have to lean into that experience of thinking that there are things that are beyond our capacity. So they've been able to capture that at very fundamental levels. Like right now, everyone listening to this will have electromagnetic sound going on around them, whether they're listening on their phone or to a radio, a television, wherever they happen to be getting their audio coming from. There'll be these electromagnetic sounds that travel without an atmosphere. And you can get these little devices like electromagnetic receivers, something as simple as a copper coil, which a lot of people, a lot of more mature people might recognize from their telephones in the 1980s and early 90s. That copper coil receiver can translate some of those sounds. And there are other devices you can use that basically allow you to hear the electrical componentry of something like your iPhone. Mm. And when I'm working on field recording workshops, often I demonstrate this, and it's this wonderful reveal because people recognize that there is all of this information around us that we just have no relationship with because it doesn't choose to engage with, you know, our embodied listening.
Hmm. How do you think field recording might serve us in the years ahead? I mean, are there things that it might help us explore in the future?
I think going forward, it's going to have huge applications in VR and augmented reality, and it already does. It's going to also have a very important role to play in terms of quantitative work in science, like when we're looking at questions like biomass and diversity and environments. Sound, and particularly the relationship between sound and emerging AI technologies, means that there can be a great gathering of material quite quickly because of the processing is not linear anymore. It's not time-based. You can look at an audio file, scan through that, and discover how many variations of a call there might be very quickly. Qualitatively, though, I think it will serve a really important function because it allows, or at least it invites, a kind of, I'm not sure if escape is the right word, but it invites a way to reconsider or refocus your relationship to place.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think we've quite got to that stage yet where it's quite arrived there. But I think increasingly, even if we look in terms of like the use of field recordings in installation or gallery settings, there's an invitation for the mind to open out with sound that is slightly different to the way that it works with our eyes. Sound is all around us in a way that sight is not. Sight's very linear. It's kind of singular in a way,
mm-hmm.
where there is this sort of atmospheric quality to sound, and it opens itself out, and in the process, I think, opens us out as listeners to it. And I think field recording's role in that space, we're only just beginning to understand how it can assist in that opening out.
Lawrence English is a composer, artist, and curator based in Brisbane, Australia. You've been listening to Spark. The show is made by Michelle Parisi, Samarit Johannes, McKenna Hadley-Burke, and me, Nora Young. And by Patrick Feaster, Summer McCoy, and Lawrence English. Follow Spark on your favorite podcast app, and you can find us on social media, SparkCBC. I'm Nora Young. Talk to you soon.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.